Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Hosts Gene and Tim, along with team members
Teresa, Linda, and Annie,
are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Green Counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Hey, we're here on our road trip to Ithaca, Cornell University, and we're talking to all these amazing experts. We're kind of in awe, aren't we, Jane?
We are. We are so far over our heads.
We are.
But we have a whole bunch of appointments, and then we started trolling the hallways and kidnapping. So today we have Brian Brown with us, who is the Integrated Weed Management Specialist in New York State and Integrated Pest Management Program.
And he says that to all people at cocktail parties really quickly to see and impress them, right? Is there an acronym or is there something that you use?
I haven't used that at a party, but yeah, I should. Yeah, New York State IPM is one way to shorten it.
It's really an incredibly important resource for us anyway, because we get so many questions on weed and invasive management. It's one thing to kind of identify what you have in your property, or if you're a farmer, but the management piece of it's really important. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got here to Cornell and
yeah.
your current position?
Well, first, just getting to this room. Thank you so much for...
Well, you had no choice.
I heard Tony DiTommaso's voice earlier, and I came over to say hi, and you have this great podcast
studio. He lured you into the room.
Set up. So thank you. And this is just so fun to do this right off the cuff. Yeah, so my background, let's see, how in-depth to go. I was born in... I did my undergrad in biology, but I was always interested in farming. So I kept going back and forth, biology and farming. And finally, I found this little niche when I was thinking about going to grad school of weed biology, weed ecology. And it kind of married those two subjects. And I really delved into ecologically based weed management, looking into, to things like mulches and cover crops, cultivation, physically controlling weeds, and did that for a few years. And then when I finished, this job opened up here at Cornell in the New York State IPM program. And it really dovetailed nicely as integrated pest management. A key part of that is working and integrating as many different tactics as feasible to try to keep the weeds off balance. And a lot of times that's with herbicides, but also with these other kind of ecologically based strategies. And yeah, so I now cover all crops across the state, and also garden and landscape settings where weeds are found, and really try to help farmers and land managers manage weeds, control weeds successfully, and improve the control, typically if I'm getting calls from folks, but also in a way that minimizes the risk to the environment, to human health, and to economic bottom line if it's a business.
So being IPM and avoiding chemicals, when we were talking to Tony, he was comparing all of this weed control and the whole system of gardening as a military operation. So what you're doing is hand-to-hand combat instead of nuking things, right? Kind of?
We try to get away from military analogies where we can, but there's many different ways to think about weeds and what is a weed. I'm sure you talked about with Tony. It's a very subjective thing, and a lot of so-called weeds have beneficial aspects to them. And so certainly it's great if we can take a very measured look at what is in a particular garden or farm and manage it accordingly based on which species are there, and using knowledge of the biology of the species. And I like to say that each weed has an Achilles heel.
We have to find out some of those.
And so I try to search the previous literature on all the previous research that's been done for what are the Achilles heels for each particular species. You know, for example, I was just in the New York City area visiting some urban farms, and a lot of them had massive amounts of galansoga, a weed that is relatively recent, and so we just call it by its scientific genus. It's galansoga quadriradiata, formerly galansoga ciliata, I believe. But yeah, this weed is so successful because you can have multiple generations in a year. It can produce seed so quickly, less than 3 weeks in some cases, towards the end of the season. And then that seed goes into the ground and you get another flush from the seed that was just produced, whereas normally the seed requires an overwintering period.
Well, and it's little and it's fluffy and it looks harmless.
Yeah.
I don't know this plant at all, galansoga.
Okay. Well, you're lucky. Yeah. So.
I mean, do we have it in the Hudson Valley or is it mostly?
Yeah.
We do.
It's,
okay.
It's across. Yeah, it's to the northeast now.
Look in the book.
But the Achilles heel, I feel, with galansoga is that the seed really lacks dormancy. And it has a half-life, so about half of the seed just dies of natural causes within a year. So if a farmer or gardener can be very successful in controlling galansoga for 1 year, they'll have almost none than the following year.
And then it's a geometrically less each year.
Yes, that's right. Yep, exponential decay kind of thing. Yep.
So you're really looking about kind of their reproductive cycles a lot in terms of if it's an annual, if it's a biennial, if it's a perennial, and if it's more reproduces by seed or it's spreading by roots and things like that.
All of these things, have a huge impact on the success of which weed species are going to thrive in a certain environment with certain management and which ones aren't. And so, it's finding out, what is it about the management that allows certain weed species with certain traits, be it, their summer annuals, like you say, or their perennials that have rhizomes and creeping root systems? Do they emerge typically in May? Do they emerge in June? All of these things, the size of the seed. I don't know if Tony, that's a big aspect of his book. How many seeds that they produce in many of our worst or most problematic weeds can produce many thousands.
Right.
I have a bag, like a small, like a sandwich size Ziploc bag full of lamb's quarter seed from one plant. and that's about 300,000, 400,000 seeds. So just imagine tossing that Ziploc bag of seeds over your shoulder in your garden and imagine what will happen. So it definitely makes sense to really try as hard as you can to prevent seed production, because you're absolutely shooting yourself in the foot if you're letting weeds go to seed regularly.
Are you finding commonalities then of, say, something like that you're talking about? So something that produces 10,000 seeds, but that they don't last long in the soil. Or there's certain factors that then you can say, at some point you can say, it's this kind of plant that does this, or plants so individual in their reproductive strategies and processes that you're going to have to do it plant by plant.
That's a great question related to the seed size and the longevity of the seed in the soil. I'm just thinking of a few examples. Unfortunately, I don't know of a specific trend. I'm thinking of lamb's quarters, which I just mentioned has very small seeds, but can persist in the soil for quite a while.
I'm thinking of kind of woodies. And so like everybody wants to have kind of a general strategy for certain plants so that you don't have to look at everything. So I'm thinking of woodies like bush honeysuckle and autumn olive. And maybe because they're fairly similar in that they're woody, you can cut them down. And I know we're thinking IBM, cut them down and paint them. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a common strategy because I don't think that any gardener is going to be able to learn every plant. That's why I'm kind of asking.
Right.
That question.
Yeah. Yeah. For generalities.
Yeah.
So, as far as generalities go, summer annuals and winter annuals are more dependent on seeds. That's how they get through the winter in the form of a seed. So seed production is more important in preventing seed production for annuals, whereas perennials will have some type of overwintering structure in their roots, be it rhizomes or thickened tap roots. And so it's a different strategy to prevent that. So Anytime basically you see perennials with a significant number of leaves, say if it's quackgrass or yellow nut sedge or field bindweed, Canada thistle, someone mentioned earlier. Yeah. Anytime you see those perennials with more than a handful of leaves, they are sending resources down into the ground and getting stronger and probably spreading via their root system. So you really have to stay on top of perennials, I think, more so than annuals, which, you know, an annual may be competing with the crop, but in some respects, you could come through at the end of the season before it goes to seed, say in mid-August, and pull it, get it off out of the garden, and it's kind of like no harm done. Whereas perennials, you know, as long as they're there, they're sending resources down and expanding. So it's like you really have to stay on top of those.
And if there's a piece of root of a perennial, you probably want to make sure you get all of that, or even if you get most of the plant, it might come back again, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like I mentioned, field bindweed, it can spread via root fragments of just a couple inches long. So it's tempting to go out and rototill it, but you could be spreading it. You're breaking up those roots and moving the root fragments to another part of the garden where it could establish and grow. So
it's a matter of recognition like that, knowing that that's going to happen and knowing what a rosette implies when you've got, again, with the thistles, you've got those nice rosettes that come for the next year's crop. If you see and recognize the rosette, you can deal with it and head off a year's worth of agita. So back to Tony's book, knowing the different life stages of a lot of these things heads off a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and just being observant about, you know, which species and I like to encourage folks to keep a garden notebook and take notes and maybe make little drawings about which species you have and where are they. I think a garden map, you know, this is something we do in IPM, especially in other aspects for scouting. And so scouting your area that you're managing and mapping out which species are where, because it will likely be the same in the subsequent years. So you could prepare for that and know, oh, okay, this is an area where I have common ragweed emerging very early. This is one of our earliest emerging species. It's coming up in April and May and is kind of pretty much done by June. So maybe I'll let that happen and then I'll come through and rototill and plant that area late. So I'll completely avoid the ragweed.
Outsmart them.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'm the definition queen and I just realized that we're happily rambling on about IPM without defining it. Could you define IPM?
So IPM really developed after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and DDT and looking at pesticide usage. And how can we control pests adequately without doing unnecessary harm? And so to me, one of the key tenets of IPM is scouting and only spraying if you need to, basically. So for a lot of pests, particularly for insect pests and some pathogens, there are certain thresholds. If you have 3 bugs per leaf, for example, they're going to do significant damage that it makes it economically worthwhile for you to spray some kind of control at that point. So that's kind of the origin of IPM. We don't typically use those kinds of thresholds for weeds, the main reason being that they produce seeds.
Right.
So I like to promote not a zero weed threshold, but a zero seed threshold and trying to really limit the amount of seed that goes back into the ground and for perennials, the amount that they can spread with their roots.
So we talked about annuals and we talked about perennials, biennials like garlic, mustard, because I've heard different things about this. So since I have you here captive and I have lots of bad garlic mustard and it's killed out whole beds of mine because it's allelopathic, the strategy for garlic mustard, since it is a biennial, is it to get rid of the kind of the first year's rosettes, or is it you wait and you cut the flower because you're really trying to get rid of seed production for that, right? I mean, tell me your expert opinion.
I have to confess, this is landscape weed management is a little bit of a new area for me, but you know, just applying general principles. Yeah, any time you can control it, I think is going to be effective. You know, thinking about If you are hand pulling, I think it would make most sense to go in after a rain when the soil is wet and you can, you know, very quickly remove the whole root system. Mm-hmm. I would worry about, you know, just pulling off a leaf or two and breaking. But then as far as spraying, you know, if you do go that route, to be sure to check the label for when the optimal time to spray is, you know, based on the label and what is allowed as far as the law goes. Typically, perennials, and I think this would be true for biennials in their first year, they're preparing for winter. So they're sending resources underground, especially late summer and fall. They're sending a lot of carbohydrates down into the root system. And so a systemic application of like glyphosate at that time, the plant helps you because it brings the herbicide down into the root system with its other sugars and such. So it can help the herbicides be more effective. There have been eradication efforts for landscape weeds, and you know, Japanese knotweed is another one that is really spread through New York, and you see it on most of our streams, it seems. And what I feel is that the most effective methods for controlling these weeds are going to be through biological control. So, for example, with purple loosestrife, which is another invasive landscape weed that used to just dominate places like the Montezuma Wildlife Refuge, it would be just a sea of purple. There was a successful biocontrol developed, a weevil, or I think two different species. And now you drive by, and it's still there a little bit, but it's in check with the other species. And so that's what the efforts are really focusing on for these rampant invasive
weeds. And are there
efforts
for like Japanese knotweed, like biological controls?
Yeah, and there's research in New York as well as elsewhere to try to regain some balance with some of these invasive plants.
It's a longer cycle, though, right? Because they have to do a lot of experimentation to make sure that they're not going to make more problems, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to make sure that if it's an insect that they're bringing in from the plant's native range, that insect isn't going to become invasive itself. So
do you have any previews of biological controls that are coming down the road that will make us hopeful and happy?
There are things in the pipeline. There are species that are being looked at, and I do back at my desk have a list of the species and the status. Some are very early stages, but some are being close to being released. And so, yeah, it's exciting that this could potentially turn the tables for us.
Oh, that's great.
My follow-up question on the garlic mustard is sort of another rabbit hole. It's an allelopath, which we have to define. An allelopath is something that poisons the soil around itself so that other plants don't thrive.
I wouldn't say poison, but it produces some type of chemical that the plant that exudes it can tolerate, but the other plants cannot.
Right.
And so, yeah, sometimes this is exuded through the roots and will affect other nearby plants. Or sometimes, as in the case with cover crops, like a lot of our cover crop species have some degree of allelopathy where we'll terminate the cover crop and incorporate them into the soil, but you don't want to plant your crop right away because there is a little bit of allelopathic stuff going on for a couple weeks. So
that's
my
next question. Yeah, how long once an allelopath is put in the soil? What's their expiration date?
So for cover crops, I would wait a couple weeks for those to kind of break down, for the microbes to eat up those allelopathic chemicals and turn them into other things. I don't know for garlic mustard or for other species. I believe spotted knapweed has some degree of allelopathy as well, and that's another biennial. So I don't deal with that many biennials that, you know, that I see them in old hay fields that have been abandoned, you know, spotted knapweed, Kyle parsnip, wild carrot. But for the most part in agricultural and in gardens, which is where I'm mostly, is it's annuals. It's typically summer annuals and very aggressive perennials.
Huh. I mean, I have seen the spotted knapweed all over Columbia County, especially when I'll go out on like a master forest owner visit, and it's all through people's lawn even. So it's like they basically have almost a lawn of spotted knapweed that they're mowing. So it just seems like there's a huge amount of it. And that seems like a really tough one to get rid of because it has such a fibrousy root that just kind of stays in the soil. It's not pullable, I don't think.
So depending on the frequency of mowing, lawns and similarly, you know, well-managed hay fields that get several cuttings a year tend to be really good for suppressing weeds. And, you know, grasses are excellent competitors. And, you know, depending on the mowing height and the timing of mowing, usually after a few years of hay fields or turf management, it really depletes the weed seed bank and other species. So I think it's a great tactic in thinking about rotation. Like, how could I, you know, deplete the weed seed bank in advance of planting my next crop? Going to hay, repeatedly mowing, it typically favors the grasses. And of course, there's grass weeds as well, like large crabgrass or smooth crabgrass. But many of those, like those crabgrasses, tend to be spreading or sprawling. And so if you're mowing, we like to recommend at a 4-inch height, which is rather high, kind of the highest setting for some mowers. That can actually shift the competitive balance so that other more well-behaved grasses, maybe the ones that you want in a lawn, would outcompete the sprawling, the spreading grasses.
Is that true also if you want to have like clovers and things like that for pollinators, that you bring the lawnmower up a bit so that you have some of those and you're not really cutting those down all the time? I mean, I have a non-grass lawn almost with things like that.
That's a good question. So grasses being a lot of them with a kind of a vertical structure, if you're clipping them very short, you know, there's almost no leaf tissue left that they're going to be able to use for photosynthesis. Whereas plants that have a basal rosette you mentioned earlier, that kind of they spread out and have leaves basically right on the ground, dandelions like plantains,
yeah,
they can get plenty of light and produce all the energy they need and probably be more competitive than the grasses if you're mowing it at say 1 or 2 inches. Mm-hmm. So it can be challenging in that respect. Where clovers stand, I'm not sure. I think it varies a little bit by the clovers. I know like white clover is fairly low growing, whereas some of the other ones tend to be taller and probably would persist better at a higher mowing height.
I'm hearing all this about eco lawns, and a lot of them have clover in it. And I assume that it just generally, if you mow a little bit higher, you're going to maintain more of that.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
And I don't know if you can answer this, but it's one of those things that I've been seeing anecdotally, which is especially with kind of invasive things like stilt grass and garlic mustard, they seem to have some symbiosis with other bad invasive things like jumping worms. And I don't know if you've done any kind of research on that, but it seems like...
I have heard that as well. Yeah. And I know that, you know, in general, I think a disturbed type of environment. So if it's something that, you know, maybe it's a roadside or an area that is mined for gravel or something. Yeah, it's disturbed. And so, you know, weeds are going to be the early colonizers of disturbed ground. And I think that, you know, disturbed sites as well, a lot of times, you know, what is being brought in, the trash or whatever is moved to that area, may contain weed seed or weed fragments. So I'm not as well acquainted with the communities surrounding. Are there certain insect species right that are drawn to, you know, invasive weeds? But yeah, it's a fascinating new area.
I guess the question is then, if I have a disturbed site, which it sounds like it's kind of ripe for bad things coming in, maybe I want to plant fairly quickly some native seeds or throw a big pile of native seeds in that area to help compete with some of the bad stuff.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah. And just, it is challenging. Just be aware, you know, some of the things that we've learned in doing some trials, planting, you know, native, excellent, you know, pollinator resources, good flowers and such. So we had higher success getting them established when they were transplanted as the direct seeded species. You're throwing them on the ground, and then typically there will be some kind of established plant there, grasses or whatnot, that they would have to immediately compete against and be at a disadvantage height-wise against. So it's the preparation of the ground is critical, and we tested a few different things, including solarizing the ground with clear plastic to superheat the soil and and kill the existing seed bank down in the top couple inches, as well as existing plants, using repeated tillage or herbicides. So whatever the method, it's going to be most effective if you're starting with
plugs or something.
Starting with a clean slate as far as weed goes, right. But plugs if you can afford them. Otherwise, if you are direct seeding, I think it's best if you can do so in strips where you know, okay, this was the strip that I planted. And if it's in a straight line, or maybe you've marked it with a string, you can say, okay, I'm going to come through and mow or some other way weed where I didn't plant. So you can kind of give those seeded plants a competitive advantage and help them establish.
Interesting.
So I've done quite a bit of work with physical weed control, looking at using hoes or cultivation equipment. We have a hoe library that we kind of send around the state.
Oh, I love it.
And we have 20 or so different hoes. Because what we found actually, and this is backed up in other states with research, is that there's no one best hoe that controls weeds the best and is most ergonomic to everybody, but that everyone likes a different hoe. And as long as it suits you and kind of speaks to you, that's going to be the best hoe for you.
So it's not like you have the perfect hoe.
Right. And so that's why we're sending these things out to various field events across the state throughout the summer. Let people try them and see, well, this one works for me, or I don't like this one. Because a lot of them are kind of expensive. And so you want to make sure to try it before you put down $100. Also on the line of cultivation, a couple years ago, I went around the state with a slow motion camera, a GoPro camera, attached it to various cultivation equipment in farmers' fields. And we really learned a lot about the operation of cultivators and how weeds are killed through use of physically disturbing the soil. And you know, there's different types of tools. Some of them undercut the soil with kind of a knife blade or hoe blade. Others have more spring to them and will do more uprooting. Or another category that we saw is tools that bury weeds. And so all these types of mechanisms for controlling weeds, I think, should be on the table for folks and know about, okay, I can cut them, I can uproot them, like a lot of us do with hand pulling, or I could even bury them.
So you deal with weeds, which is a little depressing, right? So tell us what gives you hope in your daily life in terms of that.
Well, I love managing weeds. I think it's a fun challenge to try to control weeds and think about the biology of each one and the traits that's kind of stick out. What makes each weed unique that we could target for management while keeping our desirable crop plants. So I have a great time with it. And I think one of the positives in the past 10 years or so is that farmers and gardeners are increasingly looking to cover crops, which is a very ecologically minded approach that have many benefits in terms of soil health, reducing erosion, et cetera, breaking other pest cycles. And so looking to cover crops to suppress weeds either while they're growing or when they're terminated, to use that residue, the dead cover crop, to form a mulch to suppress weeds. So there's a lot of exciting research going on there, and factor that in with all the robotics companies that are getting into the weed management game, seeing where herbicides are struggling in some areas to try to fill in those gaps. I think it's going to be very different in the next 10 years, if you're looking at how we're managing weeds.
Oh, that's great. That's great news.
Well, that sounds hopeful.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was fun to be here.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Powers and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.